Hello, this is episode number 29 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, September 13, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On this week's show, we're going to be discussing the issue of wireless piggybacking. For those of you who aren't familiar with that, wireless piggybacking generally refers to the practice of using someone else's open Wi-Fi network, either with permission or, as is often the case, without permission. Today we'll be debating what, if anything, should be done about this practice. Is it moral or immoral? What is the legal status of wireless piggybacking? Is it theft of service or just harmless sharing? And how should companies respond to the practice, if at all? Joining us this week to discuss this issue are my fellow Technology Liberation Front contributors, Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
James Gattuso of the Heritage Foundation.
Hello.
And we're also joined this week by two very special guests. First, we have Ben Worthen of the Wall Street Journal's Business Technology blog. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Adam.
And Mike Manzik of TechDirt. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Adam.
Ben Worthen, I'm going to start with you because a few weeks ago you authored a very interesting article on this issue for the Wall Street Journal Business Tech blog. And in that article, which was entitled Wi-Fi Squatting and You, you pointed out that a man in London had actually recently been arrested for wireless piggybacking. Tell us about that incident and your general views on this issue.
Yeah, so that's right. I was just looking through the BBC, and there was this very short report saying that a man had been sitting outside someone's home using his laptop, and the police came up and questioned him, and it turns out he was just checking his email or using the internet on someone else's unsecured wireless network. It turns out there's a British law called the Communications Act of 2003 that actually makes it a crime to dishonestly obtain free internet access. And so, you know, they arrested him right there. I did a little bit of research, and it turns out the FBI says this isn't a federal offense unless the network is encrypted. So if it's an unencrypted network, you're fine. But different states have different laws. People have been arrested in Michigan, Florida, and Illinois for Wi-Fi squatting. I thought this was very interesting because it's something that, honestly, I have done from time to time, and I've never even thought twice about it. My feeling was I needed to get online, and I would just go ahead and do it. But apparently, you can get arrested for it.
The cases that you've seen, how stiff were those sentences? Do you have any idea what the penalties look like?
You know, I don't. As best I can tell, no one has actually been put in jail or even fined. This is not, I think everybody realizes that this is a legal gray area. The people who have done this, well, so apparently one thing that's a really bad idea if you're going to do this, use someone else's unsecured wireless network, don't sit in front of your car outside a library after hours or a coffee shop, because apparently that's where these people all get arrested. I think they don't know. I don't think they have any idea that they're doing anything wrong. And my feeling is that the police don't really want to treat them like someone who robbed a bank or anything like that.
Did you say a library?
Yeah, libraries oftentimes will have free internet access.
That seems really bizarre. So if you come into the library, libraries aren't selling anything. So if you come into the library, it's just fine. But if you're in your car using the exact same internet access that's free to the public, then they get bent out of shape?
Yeah, well, you know, hey, I'm not writing the law.
there was at least one case where someone was definitely arrested outside of a library, but I think it was also that it was after hours, even though the library had left the Wi-Fi turned on.
Well, it'd be the same principle as loitering. If you're sitting outside the library, you can even be arrested for loitering, but if you're sitting inside the library all day long, you're just doing research. So.
Well, okay, let me move the discussion along and mention the fact that after I saw Ben's story on the Wall Street Journal Business Tech blog, I wrote a piece about it myself on the TLF called Wi-Fi Piggybacking Reconsidered. And although I agree, I think we all can agree, that arresting anyone for this is downright silly, if not somewhat offensive, going way too far, I did raise the question about whether or not there was a potential legitimate harm or concern associated with what might be considered excessive sharing of networks or piggybacking. And so let's get into a discussion about, you know, what constitutes acceptable sharing of these networks or what might be regarded as by some carriers a theft of service. And I put forward in my essay, and this is something that Mike Manzik of TechDirt responded to, so I'm going to let him respond after I outline this. I put forward this scenario about what happens in a world where people essentially start openly sharing Wi-Fi against their stipulated usage restrictions in their end-user licensing agreement or whatever else, or their terms of service contract with their broadband carrier. I put forward the argument that there could be some harm there, because obviously the carriers want to get paid for delivering broadband to all consumers in that neighborhood. And if one consumer takes and shares that network with everyone, or if everyone alternatively just starts using it because it's open, one could see that there might be some harm there. So, Mike, you responded to that argument. I'm going to go ahead and let you respond to that before I say anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple different points that I tried to make, which are that it's kind of a highly speculative situation that really only occurs in a very small number of cases where you would have someone who would then be offering shared internet access to a large number of other people who would then forego signing up for broadband themselves. And we haven't, even though that's possible today, you don't see that very often. There may be one or two like small cases where neighboring apartments might share Wi-Fi, but even then, there are a number of problems with that. I think I mentioned some of them, like, you know, if you have to reset the router and it's in your neighbor's apartment, you can't do that. And there are just other little problems. If something goes wrong, you don't have access to it and you can't do anything about it. So I think it becomes less and less. You just don't see it. I mean, in most apartments, if you sit in an apartment building these days, you turn on your computer, you can usually see, you know, tons of different Wi-Fi networks. So I don't think I think it's highly speculative. And then the second issue is the question of harm. I mean, you talk about it causing harm. And, you know, to me, it's just a competitive or a market situation. It's the same thing as, you know, if there's DSL and cable, if everyone who decides to sign up for cable, they're not signing up for DSL, then according to the way you defined it, at least, it seems like, you know, the cable provider is now harming the DSL provider. But we don't consider that harm. We consider that, you know, a marketing challenge. So I consider the same thing. If you have a problem with people setting up and sharing Wi-Fi, that's a marketing challenge, not harm.
Tim, you also responded, and you, of course, wrote on this extensively last year, and you wrote a piece that I believe eventually was in the New York Times, essentially called In Defense of Piggybacking, in which you argued that there's absolutely nothing wrong with connecting to someone's unprotected network. Tell us a little bit about your take on this.
Sure. Well, I don't think, Adam, we're actually that far apart. I mean, the point I was making in the New York Times article is the one that I think you just said we all endorse, which is that there's nothing wrong with occasional, casual checking. I mean, the example I used in the piece was when I moved to St. Louis and I was apartment hunting, I would look at an apartment, and then I'd hop back in my car, and usually there'd be a Wi-Fi network within distance, and I'd use it to check my email and, you know, find out what the next apartment I was going to look at was. And it was just completely harmless. I do think there's a couple of distinctions to be made. One is the distinction between sharing somebody else's network and making your own available. I think that sharing somebody else's network in a casual setting is completely harmless. I do think there are actually some good responses to my piece on the sharing your network side. There are some not completely crazy security concerns where that, you know, that's a decision you have to weigh the cost and benefits. The other distinction I think we need to make is between unethical and illegal. I mean, I do think there's at least an argument that that sharing your Wi-Fi network with a large number of your neighbors is at the very least a breach of contract and arguably unethical. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there should be any sort of special legal or regulatory apparatus to deal with that. I mean, if your cable company wants to prevent you from sharing your internet access, there's all sorts of ways they can do that. From, they can send a technician around to look for open networks. They can make you use their preferred Wi-Fi network. They can, you know, do various kinds of traffic analysis. One of the examples you talked about is metering traffic. So in a competitive
We're going to get into metering in a second, Tim, but let me ask you just to mention the fact that in your essay you mentioned that a big part of this problem comes about because essentially people are, well, let's face it, just too stupid to set their network password.
Right.
And, you know, it's, you know, for tech wonks like us, that doesn't seem too hard.
Right.
But for a lot of average Joes and Janes out there, that might be a problem. I mean, is there an easy solution to that other than maybe the ISP can hand out a card to everybody saying here's how you do it, or I don't know.
Well, I think a lot of that actually can be laid at the feet of the Wi-Fi manufacturers. I mean, it is kind of a hard problem to design technology that's easy to use, and obviously you don't want to have the default be something where clueless people can't use the router at all. And so I think that's why they've done it open by default, because you know, they don't want the clueless people to be completely locked out of their routers. But certainly this is an area where I think there's a market opportunity for, you know, a wireless vendor to, you know, alert people of the fact that their networks might be open when they don't want them to, and say our router is easier than anybody else's to close your network down.
James, let me ask you to contribute your thoughts to this and also maybe address, you know, getting back to the legal issues, because we've been covering telecom and cable policy issues for a long time, where there are different types of, you know, theft of service issues, as some carriers might regard it. I use the example in the cable context of how some people have tried to share cable signals in the past by using splitters to split signals and share, instead of one, you know, take one cable subscription and share it across an entire apartment or something. Now, I'm not saying that's the exact analogy, but these questions of you know, theft of service or, you know, how to abide by terms of service in a contract, they've come up in the field of communications and cable before, correct?
It comes up all the time of cable theft. And another analogy that comes to mind is not electronic, but just the sharing of trade and magazine subscriptions. Some of these are rather expensive. You get things like an industry letter like Communications Daily. If I wanted to get one subscription to it and share it with others, I get into trouble for that and have a great deal of liability. So there might be an analogy there. You know, you look at this, it looks like we're dealing with at least three distinct questions, each of which may have their own answer. I know we don't have a lot of time here, but the first one is, can I share my service with my neighbor? Can my neighbor take part of the service that I have? And that's between me and my neighbor. Tim, in his op-ed in the New York Times, gave the example of borrowing a cup of sugar. Maybe that's the analogy we want, but my neighbor does have to ask me in advance before they take the sugar from me. The second question is, can my Wi-Fi provider stop me from sharing anything with my neighbor? And that, again, I think is a matter of voluntary arrangement and contracts. My view is that the Wi-Fi provider wants to prevent that, and there are good economic reasons they may want to. They should be able to. The third question, and in my view the hardest one, is should a violation of this sort of that contract be made a criminal violation? And there are some cases where that makes sense. I'm a little bit wary about making anything a criminal violation. You're getting the police involved. You may be expanding the problem beyond where it is true significance. But that's the area where I had the most difficulty. But there are three distinct questions in my mind.
You know, one of the things that you know, I think is so interesting about this is that you know, the internet in general is, you know, it's something that the legal system just hasn't caught up to. And, you know, when, you know, so people kept posting analogies for what would be a law that you're breaking. Someone said, if I'm watching a neighbor's television through their window, is that a crime? Or if someone has a sprinkler on and it's spraying water that's about to run down a drain in the sidewalk and I open my mouth and get something in my mouth, am I stealing something from them? And, you know, it seems, I don't know, I guess I can't help the feeling that if we pass a law that criminalizes this or that even deals with this in any explicit way, we're just dealing with a very temporary problem. You know, the problem now, it seems to be that there's demand for people to have internet access wherever they are, right? If it's, you know, if you're checking, you know, apartments in St. Louis, you want to check your email at the same time. And, you know, there's some emerging technologies that will let people have that ubiquitous internet experience, if you will. And it seems like, you know, any attempt to put in place a law that limits, you know, the current situation is going to be outdated within a year or two.
I think we can probably all agree, at least all of us on this call, that we don't want a law dealing with wireless piggybacking or whatever we were calling it. Wireless Wi-Fi squatting. I don't want a law. I don't think anybody does. But there is a legitimate question about terms of service and enforcement of contracts between a carrier and the customer. And that is, I think, the sticky issue here, which is that if anything ever went to court or somebody wanted to pursue it that far, should the law evolve, or would it be socially beneficial if the law evolves such that there was some sort of a right of enforcement on these things? And I would regard that what Tim's argument is a good one, is that at the margins, this casual use should just be largely ignored because it is really quite, well, marginal. It doesn't have a big influence on networks or the provision of those networks. But in the case of what I would regard as sort of intentional, massive, widespread, intentional sharing, there might be a legitimate harm in the form that, well, the whole neighborhood, if it was sharing off one node, isn't paying for it, and the carriers are less likely to provide the kind of service they could in those neighborhoods, and that might hurt, you know, overall social welfare.
I have no problem whatsoever with you know, a company putting this in their terms of service that they don't allow sharing, and then if you violate those terms of service, then the company has every right to cut you off for breaking the terms of service. I don't have a problem with that. I don't see why it should ever reach the point that it becomes, you know, a criminal offense or should involve the police in any way. And at the same time, you know, I think that then just becomes, once again, I keep going back to if this is a, you know, a harm issue or a marketplace issue. And, you know, it becomes an opportunity for other providers, if other providers are present, to have a more friendly presence. And already you have companies like Speakeasy, the DSL provider, which encourages you to share your broadband connection, and they don't have the same terms where, you know, saying that it's a violation to share your connection with a neighbor. They actually encourage it, and that becomes a value and a reason why people might sign up with Speakeasy over, you know, an AT&T or a Verizon or someone.
Well, let me ask you this, Mike, because this is something we've sort of gone back and forth on the blogs about as well. Speaking of marketplace solutions, one new business model that I have proposed, which I think could possibly alleviate some of this problem, is that if we lived in a world where there were metered solutions to bandwidth issues, there might be a way for a carrier to essentially just price the pipe over and above a certain amount of usage, such that excessive use was metered and people would better self-monitor their usage and therefore take steps to protect networks. Now, you've responded today on the TechDirt website to this argument and said, no, this is an innovation killer. Why don't you tell us what you think about
that?
Sure.
So, I think you're right that this would – that if you did metered broadband, it would force people to pay more attention to it. It would force them to change their habits and be much more aware of how their broadband was being used. So on that, you're absolutely correct. However, I think the overall harm of moving to a more metered solution outweighs that small benefit, which is really correcting a problem at the margins that I don't even think is really much of a problem in the first place. And what it does is it adds this element overhead that makes people more wary of using their broadband to its fullest ability. It makes them much more careful about testing out or adopting new services, especially newer, more innovative, high bandwidth services that are allowing all sorts of interesting and cool things that also drive further innovation in networking technology. It just forces people to slow down their adoption of new technologies and push back the pace of innovation where metering becomes very popular.
But the problem, I guess, what I would have with that argument, obviously we meter a lot of different services and goods in our society. And I want to make clear, when I say metering proposals, I am definitely not talking about a regulatory mandate here. I'm talking about market experimentation that I would really be interested in seeing some carriers encourage, and probably only have the metering start after having a flat rate all-you-can-eat service up until a certain point. What I'm talking about is at the margin for the really aggressive and what carriers would regard as excessive users, maybe we start metering the pipe when we get to that point to solve this problem. We obviously meter a lot of other services. I mean, whether it be gas or water or, you know, we have a lot of other things that we meter. It doesn't necessarily, I think, kill innovation in every category. It also creates new types of innovation in the sense that maybe people will provide more pipes or faster pipes. I mean, that might be another alternative on the other side of the coin, the innovation coin.
if you look at the industries that are regularly metered, I don't think you'd actually call most of them particularly innovative. I mean, your gas and electric and water industries are not really considered particularly innovative. And actually, if you look at a lot of other industries that used to meter, many of them are moving more and more to a flat rate pricing system, and that's actually often led to a lot more innovation. And, you know, certainly within the telecom space, what used to be a very heavily metered thing is moving increasingly to a flat rate position for phone calls and cell phone service. And what you're seeing is newer and more interesting and more innovative services being applied to that infrastructure because people don't have to worry about it. And I think
that's a fair point.
I was going to agree with Mike and make the same point. You look at gas and electric, those are pretty much commodities that people are familiar with. They're going to use or not use. It doesn't have the same innovative features and characteristics as Wi-Fi or internet usage. You know, these carriers, I suspect, are not metering because because of the reasons Mike said, they want the users to use the product. It's something that is unfamiliar to a lot of people. They don't know how it could be used or how much they can use of it. So I suspect they don't want to meter because they don't want to discourage use. In that sense, however, I think the sharing rules, any contractual rules they put on sharing with your neighbors, are their alternative to metering. So perhaps the anti-sharing rules should be seen as the pro-innovation solution. I think the carriers see that you can't go with having no one pay for this. You need to limit the usage somehow. So instead of metering, you limit the usage by having each individual user or household or subscriber pay without sharing. It might be that trade-off that the carriers see.
I'm struck by the gas, water, electric analogy because, you know, I mean, those are utilities. And one of the things I think we're grappling with is you know, is the internet a utility in the sense that, you know, wherever I go, I expect to have it and expect it to work. Obviously, there's innovative things that are happening on it and with it. But, you know, this is a whole other can of worms. But is that something that happens, you know, that the network is just connecting us to, or is that innovation intrinsic to the network itself?
Right, good point. Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Ben Werthen, Mike Manzik, James Gattuso, and Tim Lee for joining me this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. And if you'd like to comment about something we said on today's show, you can leave a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast and leave a comment there. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes. And don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.